Tom is on a solo mission this week. Some of the stories we look at include the SEC comes out with climate change risk regulations, the Serious Fraud Office is spanked again by a London Court of Appeals, the getting rid of old data is critical going forward, Mike Volkoff takes a look at the S in ESG, we consider the FINRA and CCO liability issues, the IDB debars a construction company, the first ZTE monitorship ends, all this and more on This Week in FCPA. Welcome to This Week in FCPA for the week ending March 25, 2022, the Seeing Green edition. As the SEC releases regulations around climate change, Jay is on assignment, so Tom is doing a solo effort to look at some of the week's top compliance and ethics stories. We begin with the SEC releasing climate change risk regulations. We have several different commentators who've looked at it, from Andrew Ross Sorkin in the New York Times Deal Book, to Matt Kelly in Radical Compliance, to Tom Fox and Matt Kelly in Compliance Into the Weeds. The disclosures a company needs to make would be around greenhouse gas emissions. All companies need to disclose these that are within Scope 1, i.e. those generated by your own operations, Scope 2 generated by your purchase of electricity, and larger companies also need to report Scope 3 emissions, those generated by your supply chain. You need to report on the impact of climate-related events, such as severe weather and other natural conditions, as well as transition activities on line items in financial statements, how companies govern climate-related risks and relevant risk management processes, and if the company set a goal to transition to net zero emissions, the company needs to disclose that goal. The driver here is consistency in your disclosure, and obviously, there are some questions raised. Number one, should greenhouse gas emission disclosures be subject to internal controls? How will attestations over greenhouse gas emissions work? Third, how will disclosures square with what companies say in corporate sustainability reports? So lots to digest, and I'm sure we'll be looking at this down the road. Our next story entails the SFO being spanked yet again. More trouble for the SFO as they have another sentence overturned. This time, former SBM executive Paul Bond, who was convicted as a part of the Unoil sets of trials, and he was released based upon the misconduct of the SFO. This has been detailed in prior commentary, and continued black eye and more for the SFO, and indeed more pressure on the SFO going forward. Our next story comes to us from Mike Volkoff, who takes a look at the S in ESG, of course, in corruption, crime, and compliance. Mike talks about values-based leadership and the power of a corporate mission. Obviously, the ESG movement presents numerous opportunities for organizations to promote and improve overall performance. By injecting the important focus on sustainability, organizations can take a much broader view. He cites to the LRN 2022 Program Effectiveness Report, which has, over the past few years, in addition to this year, has talked about values-based leadership to transform culture and impact behavior, and now we see that in the S in ESG. Our next story comes to us from Harry Kasson at the FCPA blog, and it's a story about the Inter-American Development Bank, rather, debarring a Brazilian contractor last Friday for 3 years for collusive and corrupt practices related to projects in Brazil. I won't even try to pronounce the name of the bank, but it's ineligible to participate in projects and operations financed by the IDB for a 36-year period. The debarment qualifies for cross-debarment by the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, and European Bank for Construction. So we don't often see debarments, but when we do, we see how powerful they can be. Next up, an article from Matt Kelly, the coolest guy in compliance, on, of course, radical compliance. And it's around FINRA's olive branch to CCOs around CCO liabilities. FINRA said that compliance officers play an important role in facilitating compliance by promoting strong practices to protect investors and market activity. This does not automatically make them subject to supervisors, therefore subject to FINRA's supervisory requirements. This really helps CCOs by not bringing them under these rules. If a CCO reasonably discharges his duties, rather, then the CCO will be in pretty good shape, at least in the eyes of FINRA. Obviously, this is not the Securities and Exchange Commission, so there's still potential liability in that realm, and that's something that other groups are lobbying the SEC to put some clarity around potential CCO liability going forward. So at least from FINRA, CCOs now have some measure of clarity around potential liability. We are going to take a quick word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back. Our next article comes to us from lawyers from Debevoise and Plimpton in New York University's compliance and enforcement blog. And they say that data minimization and indeed data retention and destruction is a critical area for data governance. And a recent enforcement action shows why companies need to get rid of old electronic data. In January, the New York AG reached a $600,000 settlement with IMED relating to a 2020 data breach in which the attackers gained access to IMED's email account, which contained sensitive customer data for 6 years. The New York AG found multiple violations of the New York Shield Act, which requires businesses to dispose of private information within a reasonable amount of time, after which it's no longer needed for business purpose. And that was the primary violation that IMED was fined for. The article then goes on to really list out the, does list out the regulatory requirements for data retention or data disposal, including under Section 5 of the FTC, the New York Shield Act, the New York Department of Financial Services cyber rules, the Illinois Biometric Privacy Act, and the California Privacy Rights Act. So that's a great review of laws inside the United States. Of course, there's always GDPR, and the authors cite to GDPR. I also go on to list some of the challenges for companies wanting to get rid of old data. One can be corporate cultural impediments. Second, ownership and budgeting. And three, legal and regulatory holes. The authors then conclude by giving tips for overcoming the challenges of getting rid of data. They suggest starting small, recognizing that preservation rules have changed, managing expansive legal holes, automate the deletion of some very old files, limit the ability to circumvent deletion, and protect the data being retained. I found this to be really an excellent article on this point. It's not something I think that really gets talked about enough, so kudos for the Debevoise lawyers for bringing it to our attention. And really, you should, as a compliance professional, check this out to see if there's anything that you're doing which might be violating these laws. Next up, some good news, I think, for the Chinese company, finally, ZTE. They were under two settlement agreements with the United States government, one with the Federal District Court and the second with the Department of Commerce. Under the first one, they had a five-year monitorship, which has ended. They are under a second monitorship from the Department of Commerce, $1 billion fine and penalty, but at least ZTE got out of the first one. They had a very, very difficult time with their monitor, who apparently was good friends with the judge who appointed him, but the judge did let them go, at least from one monitorship. So not too much good news for ZTE recently, but I think this certainly qualifies. And so hopefully the second monitorship, which unfortunately for ZTE is scheduled to last for 10 years, will keep them on the straight and narrow. Next up, an article in Corporate Compliance Insights by Todd Fishman, Noah Brumfeld, Eunju Wang, and Elaine Johnston, entitled "Department of Justice's Criminal Antitrust Division Raises the Stakes for Ethics and Compliance with Interagency and International Support." A really interesting article about how those monitoring criminal antitrust activities now have more clarity on how the Biden administration will approach enforcement. The DOJ Antitrust Division amplified its whole-of-government approach in seeking cooperation from other agencies within the U.S. government and, indeed, enforcers overseas. Recent initiatives target the COVID-area collusion schemes that were proliferating over the past couple of years. So the whole-of-government approach to procurement collusion allegations, the Department of Justice is also changing its focus to look at supply chain disruptions and how this may have led to increased antitrust activity. This announcement follows on the heels of the Procurement Collusion Strike Force active prosecutions over the past couple of years, and I think it really portends how the DOJ will utilize as much as, or rather all, types of tools available to them. The lawyers who are the authors of this are from the law firm of Allen Avery. Next up from Navex Global, Risk and Compliance Matters blog, an excellent article from Giles Newman on the top six ESG issues for companies to tackle in 2022. So this is a great list, and it really speaks to or gives you the opportunity to benchmark your own ESG efforts going forward. So number one, ESG governance issues. Governance is critical to get right and has been the cause of some of the biggest corporate scandals. It's the G in ESG that really underpins the ability of a company to achieve its ESG goals. And the G enables us or companies to thrive from an E and an S perspective. Two, scope three emissions. There are many challenges to consider when implementing an ESG program in a supply chain, but scope three emissions may take the crown. We heard a little bit about this in the new SEC rules. Scope three emissions are emissions from your supply chain. Why is this tough to manage? Well, because for many companies, their total gas house emissions from scope three can be 90% of their overall greenhouse gas emission. It's a huge area for many companies to manage. Next up, walking the talk. Sustainability is a hot topic, great in theory, but sometimes hard in practice. So in order to successfully monitor ESG, companies have to have a strong culture, clear policies, and software in place, and you must fully integrate it. So a company can only then base its future decisions around sustainability. Number four, culture change. When it comes to implementing ESG factors in organization and value chain, it's not just about tools, but it's about employees. And employees have to make decisions every day. You can put a lot of policies and procedures in place, but remember, it's all about your employees. Number five, forming partnerships. ESG is a huge area to monitor, especially for large organizations, whether you're looking at the E, the S, or the G. So that's where partnerships are critical unless a company is in continuous contact with both suppliers and clients within their supply and value chain. Companies are never going to know the extent of their ESG measurements. And finally, ethics, compliance, regulations. Supply chains are not listless, and sometimes it can be easy to forget there are real people working in them. The UK Modern Slavery Act, the California Transparency and Supply Chain Act, Germany has the Supply Chain Due Diligence Act. All of these focus on compliance. With more modern technology, these issues are more easily monitored, but the point is that you must monitor them going forward. So a really good article here in Risk and Compliance Matters, and we hope that Giles Newman lays out some things that you can look at and the critical nature of them going forward. And our final article comes to us from Neil Hodge over at Compliance Week, who asks, is momentum building towards a privacy shield replacement? Recent comments by the EU and U.S. lawmakers and insights from privacy experts suggest a new mechanism to ensure safe transatlantic data transfers might soon be introduced. In February, directors of the Privacy Shield Program, the U.S. director, said negotiations were in the home stretch, and European officials are also saying progress is being made. If a draft comes out in May or June, it will likely gain an adequacy decision by the end of the year and come into effect soon thereafter. It would certainly be a big plus for U.S. companies to be able to know what the rules are going to be, and it sounds like things are moving in the right direction. That concludes our stories and commentary that we've seen this week, and now we're going to move to some podcasts and more. On the Compliance Life, I conclude my four-part series with Audrey Harris, who's now Managing Director at Affiliated Monitors. In episode four, she talks about her move to AMI. I had a great two-part series on greetings and felicitations with Allie McDevitt. Allie wrote a multi-part ransomware case study, which has been running in Compliance Week. We've talked about the articles, but I had the chance to sit down with Allie and talk about her research into this, how she wrote it, her writing style, and really a wide-ranging discussions. So check out parts one and two of my podcast with Allie McDevitt on her ransomware case studies. Why should you attend Compliance Week? Well, to find out, check out my podcast with Dave Lefort, Managing Director at Compliance Week, on From the Editor's Desks, which posted on Friday, March 25th. You can hear about some of the highlights, some of the panels, and keynote speakers that Dave and others at Compliance Week have organized. Even better yet, listeners to this podcast get a $200 discount to Compliance Week 2022. Use the code FOX200. I've linked to the code. I've linked to the registration site. So check out Dave's podcast and then register for Compliance Week 2022. I hope to see you there. Next up, in the Hill Country podcast, I visit with Michelle Van Fossen. Michelle's the founder of Pop Hair Art Salon in Kerrville, and she talks about her work in the salon industry for about 35 years, how she's paying it forward now in a most unique way, and her life as an actor in the local Kerrville theater scene. It's a fascinating podcast. I know you will enjoy it. She is really a firecracker, and I enjoyed interviewing her quite a bit. And finally, have you ever thought about an undergrad degree in ESG? Well, Jules Ellen Orengel thought about it, and she moreover did something about it at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and put together an undergrad degree, a bespoke undergraduate degree that she and her academic advisors helped her put together around ESG. Jules is a college student and is extremely passionate about ESG. So it was great to hear a college student really have passion around this issue and why she was, or how rather, she was able to put together entire degree around this and move forward. So check out Jules Oringel on the Compliance ESG podcast. So that concludes our podcast this week. Thank you for joining, and I hope you'll join Jay and I again next week.
This is Tom Fox again. Thank you so much for listening to This Week in FCPA. I hope you will check out my 5-part podcast series, Tax Man, on the intersection of tax and compliance. It's an area that is rarely discussed in compliance, and it turns out there's quite a bit of intersection and overlap between tax and compliance. So check it out, Tax Man, on the intersection of tax and compliance with Tracy Howell on the Innovation and Compliance podcast series on the Compliance Podcast Network. I hope you will join Jay and I again next week for another episode of This Week in FCPA. Jay can be reached at jrosen@affiliatedmonitors.com. You can reach me at tfox@tfoxlaw.com. Finally, if you've not done so, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes. It would help our ratings and help get the message out about the only weekly wrap-up of items in compliance this week in FCPA.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.